In the whole history of man, this has to be the proudest day of our lives. Because of what you have done, the heavens have become a part of man's world.
Guest on Conversations with Apollo. His name is Don. Well, first off, is it Ailes or Isles?
Isles.
Okay, I just want to make sure that I get that correct.
Yeah, good idea.
I have one of those names that are easy to mispronounce.
How do you say it?
DeRuvo. You would think that it's not. It's just DeRuvo. You think it would be real easy, but I've had it mispronounced everywhere from Reduvio to DeRuvio to Redondo to DeRuno. It's anyway. So I always like to get everybody's name pronounced correctly. So okay, 3, 2. Today's guest on Conversations with Apollo is Don Isles. He co-wrote part of the Apollo guidance software and made a name for himself writing the infamous software fix for the Apollo 14 lunar module computer, which prevented it from having to abort during landing. Mr. Isles, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. I'm happy to be with you today.
So, Mr. Isles, you started off your career. You were a young 26-year-old at the MIT Instrumentation Lab. How did you find yourself in the middle of one of the most important lunar landings, having to write this software fix to prevent disaster from happening? Tell us about your Apollo experience and take us from the very beginning.
Well, I joined the program in 1966, right out of college, basically needing a job and very lucky to have passed by MIT at a point when they were hiring for this project. And I very quickly got hooked up with a chap named Alan Klomp, whose job was to essentially create the guidance for the lunar landing phase of the mission itself.
I've had lunch with Alan Klomp.
Oh, have you?
Yes, I have. I actually had a nice long lunch with him a couple of years ago when he was still working at JPL.
Is that right? Well, he's over on this coast, and I see him every now and then. We have a traditional lunch at the solstice and equinox times, so I see him at least four times a year at those lunches. But we were very close. He was very much my mentor during the whole Apollo period, because Alan had the job of creating a practical guidance system, shall we say, for the landing, based on some work done by a man named George Cherry, who actually developed the guidance law itself. That was used, and Alan sort of translated it into a workable system. But at any rate, I was hired by George Cherry to write flight software, and Alan Klomp needed somebody like me to help him. And so we sort of worked in harness, where he was doing most of the analysis, but some of the programming, and I was doing the rest of the programming. And I think, is sort of in perhaps sort of a gadfly rule, I contributed to the, you know, the evolution of the guidance law itself. So this started in 66, and I first worked with some of the MAC programs, the ground-based programs that Alan had devised to sort of simulate the landing, and then started translating the guidance system into the computer software initially for the LEM-1 mission. That was the mission that flew the LEM, I believe it was in January of 68, that flew the LEM unmanned in Earth orbit with the primary guidance system engaged. And we did a burn, or we're going to do a burn, that sort of represented the lunar landing burn. It was, you know, an empty space. And so the results would have to be judged by, you know, tracking the spacecraft and see if it went where we intended it to. But it used the same guidance law, so it was a valid test. Unfortunately, there was a snafu on that mission, and during the burn that simulated the decent orbit insertion burn, that's the short burn that precedes the lunar landing burn by half an orbit, there was a problem where the computer cut the engine off early because it thought the engine had failed due to a parameter not having been adjusted for the expected performance of the engine. So our software did not run on LEM-1 at all, and did not run on Apollo 9 with a LEM in Earth orbit, and did not run on Apollo 10 with a LEM in lunar orbit, because neither of those missions, of course, did a landing. I did have a little bit of software that was not dedicated to the landing that was on the command module as well, so flew on those missions.
So what you're saying is the LEM guidance software was incomplete during Apollo, up until Apollo 11. It was only complete to complete the existing missions, and then once. Am I correct? Is what you're saying? I didn't know that.
Yes and no. It was somewhat an evolutionary process. You know, as I say, what we programmed for LEM-1 was the same guidance law, but of course that had to be changed quite a bit to work in lunar orbit. And it was virtually complete, I would say, at the time of Apollo 10. That's not to say we weren't still testing, and there may have been some modifications that came in, you know, sort of between Apollo 10 and 11, but the Apollo 10 spacecraft did contain software that would have allowed a lunar landing.
Okay. So going forward.
So going forward, we had a successful landing on 11. Our software, the first time it flew, did perform okay. There was the well-known problem with the overflow alarms during Apollo 11. And I'm not sure whether you're aware of the fact that the definitive paper describing those problems or that problem is my paper, which is available online. Are you aware of that?
Yes, I'm looking at it. It's on donneyles.com, D-O-N-E-Y-L-E-S, under the category LEM Tales. Tales of the Lunar Module Guidance Computer by Don Eyles. So very good read.
Oh, thank you. And so, you know, and I imagine most of your readers know the basic story there, that there was a mismatch between two 800 cycle per second power supplies that, strictly as a matter of chance, happened to be at a phase angle that caused the rendezvous radar interface to send an excessive number of pulses, meaningless pulses, to the computer. To the extent that about 13% of the computer time was drained away during the landing. And that put us right on the edge such that when anything above the, during the braking phase, which was the simpler of the two main phases, even during the braking phase, we experienced alarms after the landing radar started updating. And during the visibility phase, when there was extra software running to compute the look angle that told the astronaut where the site was and potentially modified that, that extra software pushed us even further over the edge so that we had, I believe, three more alarms during the visibility phase. the controllers in Houston, who looked at the system from a different point of view than us, you know, we didn't know why in real time, but we knew that something was stealing time from us, and it was very alarming to us because it was an unknown. The flight controllers were used to looking at the system from the outside, and they had run simulations that seemed to show that the spacecraft would keep flying in the presence of these alarm numbers. And therefore, they gave the go, and it turned out to be the right decision. If anything had happened during the mission that looked like a divergence from the trajectory, that would have been the second indication that I'm sure would have led to an abort. But at any rate, we got down safely on 11, and on 12, thanks to some new techniques we developed between the two missions, we were able to, Pete Conrad was able to put the LEM down within walking distance of a pre-selected, predetermined spot, which happened to be marked where the Surveyor, I believe it was the Surveyor 5 spacecraft, had landed a few years previously and actually brought back a piece of it.
Yeah, when you consider that Neil Armstrong basically just landed wherever he could get down, it's really impressive that Pete Conrad was, I mean, that you guys were able to help vector him right to such a precision landing.
Well, yes, Apollo 11 landed about 4 miles downrange of where it should have, and there were chiefly because of the fact that, well, it's a difficult environment. The moon has a lumpy gravitational field, as I'm sure most of your listeners know, and we had traveled around it since we had had good track. Since having good ground tracking, we had traveled around the limb, I believe I'm right in saying about 1.5 orbits. So there was plenty of time for the state vector to be, corrupted, if that's the right word, or at least become less accurate. And there was no good way to compensate for that at the last minute. I do stand corrected. I think there was ground tracking on that last pass, but there was no good way of getting that information into the computer. And as a result, we had the long downrange error on 11. And so the main innovation between 11 and 12 to make it possible was to create a new noun, as we called it, having to do with the noun verb language that we communicated with the computer with, a new noun that allowed the astronauts to key in a modification of the landing site location, which was really a correction of the state vector, but we did it backwards by moving the landing site to compensate for the state vector errors that had been analyzed out of that last-minute ground tracking as we came around the edge of the moon on the pass where we were actually going to land. So as a result of that, and of course also as a result of the good crew training using the visually very good simulators in Houston, and especially at the Cape, Pete Conrad was able to put the spacecraft right where he wanted it and did, in fact, walk to the surveyor and bring back a piece of it. So that brought us through 12, and we were feeling pretty good. And then came Apollo 13. Meanwhile, we had fixed the problem in the software. We had fixed the problem that had caused the overloads in 11. So that was not so much a worry anymore. So we had 13 where I had no role at all except to hang around and try to make myself useful for the people who, were more deeply concerned about that. But of course, as we know from the movie and from reading about it, 13 was a battle fought in Houston more than anywhere else, working out the procedures to be able to keep the limb until the last minute and make its consumables, stretch its consumables to the point where it allowed the crew to survive. And of course, seeing those chutes on Apollo 13 was one of the big moments of the whole space program. So then came 14, which had a lot of attention for several reasons. It was the first flight back after the problem with 13, the near-fatal problem on 13, and it also had Alan Shepard as the commander.
An entire quote-unquote rookie crew. Nobody had been in Apollo, in a previous Apollo mission from that entire group. All three of them.
Well, that's true. Before and no one had landed on the moon when Neil Armstrong did it either. So that's a good point. It didn't really seem to matter very much to us at the time. And of course, we did crew training with that crew. In fact, with all of the crews, and flew simulations with them, and they were very competent to do the landing.
Well, they were probably the most practiced of the crews, considering they got the extra. They switched missions with Apollo 13. They had a lot more time to practice and train. So they were probably the best trained of all the crews, I would think.
Well, I don't know. I'm not really qualified to make that kind of judgment. We always felt that Pete Conrad seemed to be the one who was taking the greatest interest in the guidance system and in the astronaut we sort of saw the most of during that period. But Alan Shepard was I can't speak too highly of him. He was a great pilot and a great limb commander and a great astronaut all around.
Yeah, I've read several biographies about about him, and you can really understand the reason why he was chosen to be the first man in space, the first guy to come, you know, to land on the moon after Apollo 13, and to run the astronaut office. I mean, he really was the embodiment of what those astronauts were. Just, you know, just a very interesting character.
Well, that's true. And of course, the period when I saw him was the happiest period of his life, probably, when, you know, up to that point, because he had undergone the long period when he was grounded. Now he was flying again and was about to go to the moon. So he was a pleasure to be with also.
Yeah, I've heard, everybody's heard the story of when he was stuck in running the astronaut office. They always had a different picture up on the wall so that people would know what mood he was in.
Yeah, I've heard the story.
The poor guy.
I don't think I ever went to his office.
Yeah, but okay. So we're at Apollo 14. They're getting ready to land on the moon, and all of a sudden they start having this abort issue. Take us through that.
Well, I'm at the lab in my office. A chap named Bruce McCoy comes in and says, "Don, the abort discrete has appeared." And I'm afraid my first reaction was a little blasé, you know, to say, "Oh, sort of, that's interesting," and stayed in my office instead of going into the room where we're monitoring the landing, monitoring the mission. And Bruce came back a few minutes later and said, "Don, the abort discrete is still appearing." So we basically walked into the next office where there was a listing of the flight program corresponding to you know, the one that was on board, and looked at the software which I had written, which looks at that switch. It's the switch, of course, that would be used during the landing to command an abort if that were necessary. And if it, and so if this discrete appeared, we would in fact abort the landing involuntarily. So we had to find some way of making the computer insensitive to this erroneous signal. So if you picture, you know, a flowchart of this very simple procedure, it had a series of checks. And of course, it had a switch that we, you know, a software switch that we turned on to activate it. We did that at the time of ignition. And the obvious thing was to use that switch to turn it back off. But of course, the trouble with that is that it was going to be automatically turned on at ignition, and some period of time would have to go past before we would be able to do the keystrokes to turn it back off again, a matter of seconds. And of course, you don't want to be hurrying when you're putting the keystrokes into the computer to change a single bit somewhere deep inside the software, because you know, a single keystroke error could be could cause something very bad to happen. But I saw that ahead of that check, fortuitously, was the check to see if an abort was already in progress. So it appeared by setting the register that indicated what major mode we were in to the abort mode, 70 or 71, that we would bypass the monitor. I should say 71, because if we were already in 70, the monitor would still have been listening for an abort stage discrete, which would have, you know, launched us into, which caused us to dump the descent stage and do the abort on ascent stage instead. So I saw that by changing the mode register to 71, we could prevent the monitor from running. And that was the core of the procedure. And that's something that we could do well before ignition, and it would cover that period immediately after ignition when the explicit switch had been turned on. So the problem was what we had to do to clean up after that. To undo the possible ill effects of having the wrong number in the mode register. Now, it wasn't as bad as you might have thought, because a great deal of what was happening had already been set in motion properly. And so those things were going to continue to function without reference to the mode register itself. But some things would not happen properly. So the procedure turned out to be to, at a point well before ignition to, or a bit before ignition, to set the mode register to 71, and then to allow the engine to light up, One of the things that would not happen as a result of having the misleading information in the mode register was throttle up. It was essential that 26 seconds after ignition, and this was one of the key times, the engine needed to be throttled up right then, or you would perturb the trajectory downstream. So we advised the astronauts to not do anything until throttle up time, and then to throttle the engine up manually and to make sure they did that on time, which they did. So at this moment, we're in orbit, we're pointing the right direction, we're burning the engine at full throttle, but we don't have the guidance engaged. That was another thing that had to happen. So the next things we did following throttle up were first to reset the bit. It was called the let abort bit, reset the bit that turned off the monitor. So now we've turned the monitor off by its intended switch. And having done that, we could restore the mode register back to 63, which was what it needed to be in. We were in P63 at that time, the braking phase. Mm-hmm. And then we loaded another register to turn on the guidance. And then the final thing that had to be done was that the manual throttle that had been used to throttle the engine up needed to be returned to minimum. The reason for that was that the throttle command was the sum of the manual command and the automatic command. And we were now commanding full throttle automatically. So having the manual throttle at its maximum didn't change anything, except that at a later point in the mission, when we throttled down into the throttleable region, if the manual throttle were still at maximum, it would prevent that throttle down, and that would have very bad consequences. It would put us off the trajectory, and in fact, if the throttle stuck at maximum for too long, the guidance would even turn the limb over to thrust downwards, which would be very disconcerting.
That would be a bad day.
That would be a bad day. That you might not recover from that. We're still at a pretty high altitude, but you, when you think about it, you cannot land on the moon softly without a throttleable engine. So a stuck throttle was an abort condition. Right. It had to be. You could put a limb through a spot on the moon with a non-throttleable engine, but you can't land so softly. You have to have that ability to hover, as it were.
Right, because it was coming to a stop and then turning off the engine so that it would gently plop to the ground. Am I correct?
Yes.
Once you get contact light, you're essentially then just shutting off the engine, and it's coming down to a gentle rest.
That's right. It's a very gentle fall, given the 1/6 G, and given the contact probe was how long was it? Do you know? I think it was fairly long, like maybe 6 feet. But
yeah, I thought it was about 6 feet. It looks pretty doggone long for the photographs.
But at any rate, the limb, the surface, the fall was still gentle enough that the landing gear absorption capability was barely exercised at all, which resulted in that long step from the bottom rung down to the surface.
Okay, so you are you find yourself in this condition, and you have to write. I guess you have to write a patch. Is it a patch, or is it just a subroutine that replaces it?
No, it was neither one of those things, and those things would have been possible. And in fact, we considered it. It would have been possible to create some new code, find a place to put it in erasable memory.
And did this all within what? I believe you had like 90 minutes. Am I correct? You didn't have much time to do it.
That's exactly right. And so we really needed a simpler solution. I mean, that was possible, but it would have been too hairy a thing, I think, to really accomplish in that period of time and have adequately tested.
I was going to say, because you would have to write it, test it, ship it off to NASA so that they could then in turn uplink it to the limb itself. And that all takes time.
Precisely. So what we did do was simpler, and it was not a patch. It was not a reprogramming. It was simply changing some data in the computer to modify the paths that that the code was going through. So it was not, it, in the strict software sense, it was not a patch.
Okay.
And at any rate, that seemed to work fine. And the next drama on that mission was that the landing radar failed to lock on. And for a reason that may not be totally understood, but it was not related to the procedure itself. It was not related to the abort switch procedure. And again, somebody at mission control had the brilliant, made the brilliant call to cycle the circuit breaker. And in fact, as soon as that was done, the landing radar instantly came on, and the landing was successful. You can't land without a good radar either. You know, even with the modifications we put in for Apollo 12, you still don't have an accurate enough navigation in altitude or in your speed over the surface to be able to go down and touch down safely without doing some radar updates on the way.
Right, because if I remember correctly, the limb has to fly along on its back for the landing radar to acquire the surface. Is that correct?
No, that's not correct. I mean, the limb, the attitude the limb is in is dictated by the guidance equation and where it needs to thrust to follow this gradual trajectory down to the surface.
Right, but for the landing radar to acquire the limb, where is the landing radar roughly on the limb itself?
It's on the bottom. It's on the bottom surface of the descent stage.
Oh, okay.
And it has two positions during the braking phase. When once we've done the roll, we're facing essentially forward, up or forward. As we get partway through the braking phase, we've already pitched forward a bit, so we're no longer totally on our back. We're sort of leaning way back, as it were, in pitch, but we're not totally on our back. And the radar in its initial position is angled in such a way that it can acquire the surface. And so we start getting good radar data, you know, during the braking phase as a result of that. But the limb does have to be pointed forward, by which the windows have to be facing up or forward, you know, depending on what our pitch is at any given moment. And at the beginning of P-64, the visibility phase, we switch guidance targets, which has the effect of making the limb pitch forward so that now the astronauts have good visibility through their windows. But as a result of that, the landing radar antenna is now not pointing in the right direction again. And so there's a second position, landing radar antenna position, that we switch to as we enter the visibility phase and have that attitude maneuver.
Okay.
And we then use landing radar data until we get down pretty close to the surface.
And then from there, the astronaut pretty much takes over.
That's right. You know, typically at 500 feet altitude or so.
Yeah. And so we got down. You got down on the moon. Now, once Apollo 14 was over, and obviously the fix that you devised was successful, it turned out that issue was it. If I remember correctly, the issue was due to an errant bead of solder that had come loose?
That's exactly right. And it's just the sort of thing you might expect. You know, a bead of solder, which would be fine in 1G, starts floating around in the switch in 0G and gets in a bad place. And they did, in fact, bring the switch down and looked at it, and that was the problem. So it was the simplest of causes. And really, compared to the Apollo 13 mission that had come before, it was a bagatelle. It was a 2-hour problem, not a week long problem, as it were.
Right.
But it attracted a lot of attention because it did come in the wake of that frightening mission.
Yes, and So Apollo 14, and then how long were you with the Apollo program all the way to the end?
Yes, I was.
And how did the limb? Obviously, the limb, like you said, it was an evolutionary process from mission to mission all the way to Apollo 17.
Yes, that's right. I mean, there wasn't too much change for the last two missions. For 15, we put in a, I believe for 15, we put in a terrain model, which made it possible to, which compensated for irregularities in the terrain, so that we made it possible for the limb to get into more geologically interesting spots that were in rougher terrain. And that made possible the more, you know, and we also, of course, had the lunar rover for those last three missions. So that made possible some extremely ambitious sort of surface exploration by those missions. You know, as you know, the Apollo 17 mission got some miles away from the limb and out of sight of it, which in my way of thinking is getting very far out on a limb.
Right. If I remember correctly, they had a didn't they have like an umbilical in case they crashed the limb, they had to walk back. They had an air sharing umbilical that they had to carry with them. So that if the case, you know, one astronaut was running low on air, they could share.
I didn't know that, but that seems logical. I hadn't known that. I know that the surface procedures were designed in such a way that if in fact the rover broke down, they could walk back.
Imagine, first off, let me ask you this one question. You said you were hired into the program fresh out of college. Do you think that part of the success of Apollo was due to the fact that so many people like yourself were fresh out of college? You didn't really know any better that you were doing something that was nearly impossible?
That might be one way to put it, but I think, you know, at all age levels, it was a program that aimed very directly and very clear-sightedly at the objective. And, you know, there was no question that everybody was motivated. And I would even say that perhaps there was a little less sort of, company, you know, chauvinism going on, also more cooperation perhaps than we've seen since. It was sort of in a unique time. It was sort of a perfect storm that led the program to get started in the first place. And I'm someone who doesn't like to contrast what we were doing on Apollo with what was going on in the society in the 60s. But I think they were actually related. You know, I think the sort of sense of adventure and idealism that we were seeing in the society to some extent, I think is one of the things that made the Apollo project as successful as it was.
Do you think that's one of the things that's missing from our current NASA program? In that, I'm fond of saying, you know, going around the block since 1973, we're NASA. I mean, do you think that part of the thing that NASA is missing is that idealism, or is it still there? It's just missing political will.
Well, I think there's a lot of it still there. And as you say, it is definitely missing political will. And I do kind of think that to have a successful space program again, the society may have to change.
I mean, because I often think that if we just had somewhere to go, then you know, it would be sexy again. You know, when I was a kid, when I was 40, before Apollo, everybody wanted to be president of the United States, and after Apollo, everybody wanted to land on the moon.
Yeah,
and now everybody wants to be a filmmaker. It's just, you know, but I mean, it's just.
Well, Mars beckons, and we could go there. There's no question we could go there. We could have gone there using the Apollo technology with some increments, you know, some pretty big increments, of course, but we could have, in a series of Saturn V launches, we could have launched a spacecraft capable of going to Mars. And sitting around the dinner table at the end of Apollo with, you know, a bunch of fellow engineers, no one at the table would have thought that we would have gone 20 years without going to Mars. But of course, I'm sorry, go ahead, James.
Much less 40.
You know, I ask myself now, what would it take to get people excited? You know, the we have tantalizing information about Mars. There may, in fact, be life forms on Mars today. Would that be enough to get people excited? I'm not even sure that would be enough.
I'm not so sure. It might be, you know, if China landed on Mars, it might be.
It might, you know, excite our chauvinism and our need to, you know, race with them. Perhaps if anybody's going to do it, it'll probably be them.
Yeah, that competitive nature that says, "Oh man, we got to get back on top." I mean, let's face it. I mean, would we have been so motivated to go to the moon if Yuri Gagarin hadn't have gone into space first?
Precisely.
And you know, Alexei Leonov was the first to walk in space. Would those things hadn't pushed us to get off the dime? And you know, I mean, it's an interesting quandary. But like you said, I think it was a perfect storm. I think it was a case of reaching into the future and pulling out a set of circumstances that prompted us to really kind of get there before it's time. And actually do it. Do you think we'll go back? Do you think we'll go back to the moon?
I'm not sure. I really am not. I'm someone who's not very encouraged by the state of the world or the state of this country or anything else going on this planet at the moment. You know, I'm minded of the theory that we have difficulty contacting any other advanced civilization, seeing evidence of any other advanced civilizations in space, because they don't last very long. That the period of time between developing radio and learning to wipe yourself out and doing it, it may not be that very long, typically. And we may be in that kind of situation where, you know, for, you know, it may be centuries. I really don't know. But it's discouraging. And I wonder, in fact, in 500 years, assuming we haven't gone back, will anyone believe we did do it?
Well, when you consider, I read a survey that said a full 20% of the people, 20% of Americans did think we faked it, which is astounding to me. I mean, I can understand, you know, 2-3% who, you know, would be those people in the weeds that are complete lunatics. But to think that if 1 in 5 actually believe we faked the Apollo moon landing, that's just amazing to me.
Yeah, no, that is staggering, and it's discouraging that people have so little confidence in humanity's abilities that they can't believe it's possible that we could have done it.
Yeah, I just. Let me ask you this. Imagine you're 26 years old again, and imagine we're going to the moon, and you have all the tools that we have today. Would the process be any different?
I'm sure it would be different. You know,
I mean, obviously, you'd be communicating over the internet. You'd have supercomputers on your desk so that you could write code and blah, blah, blah. But I mean, how?
And we would have computer speed and memory quantity enough on board way beyond our wildest imaginings at the time.
How different would that Apollo guidance software be? Would it be more automated? Would the astronauts even get to land on the moon manually?
I don't think it would be more or less automated. I think in terms of landing on a strange body, I think we hit the point between automation and manual activity about right. I think it was a good synthesis. The man was there to do the things that we had to have the man there to do, and the computer was there to do the things that the man couldn't do. And I think it was a pretty good symbiosis. What scares me about your question is, though, that, you know, we would have had the ability to put so much more in the program that maybe it would have bogged us down. Maybe the requirements wouldn't have been as sort of bare boned as they were.
It would have been bloatware.
Yes, that would be my fear. And it also has to do with the way in which it was procured. MIT, of course, is a nonprofit organization, and we were unique at that time. That's why we got the contract. There was basically no one else who could have done it. But now could have, you know, designed and built that guidance system. You know, it was technology that we were at the absolute top of. Whereas now it would fall to a different sort of structure. And I think it was a good thing that we were sort of a nonprofit during that period. It gave us sort of a neutral stance among the different industrial companies that were involved and so on. And that's something that would certainly be different if we were trying to do it now, because, you know, the guidance system technology is so much more advanced. You know, we would probably be trying to adapt software that had been built for some totally other application. Landing a limb is not so different than landing a helicopter in some ways.
Right. Were you brought when we were actually serious about going back to the moon during the Bush administration? There was talk that NASA brought a whole bunch of Apollo bets in and picked their brains. Were you one of those that got to consult?
No one picked my brain at that time about that. You know, I think a lot of people, including me, see the Bush Space Initiative as sort of a Potemkin space program. It was a lot of bombast and pretense, but not much actual action.
Kind of like his dad's, his dad's kind of, Battlestar Galactica version.
Yeah, kind of like the whole Bush presidency, if you ask me, but and you didn't.
Well, I try to keep things politically neutral on the show, because there's Apollo fans that are of the left and of the right, so I kind of keep it all political.
I know there are, and I respect the other point of view too. You know, I think Obama was in a difficult position with respect to the space program. You know, he had these expectations that had been created by, you know, but not funded. So what is he to do? And I think it was a moment when it was time to have a new paradigm with respect to traveling to Earth orbit, to try to put that more in the hands of private industry, I think was a wise thing to do. Unfortunately, I don't think NASA has been able to wholeheartedly adopt that paradigm. I think we've sort of fallen between two stools. I think, you know, the professionals in the business now, and of course I'm long retired, are just wishing they would do something, you know, make up their minds totally what they were going to do.
Right. Especially with the upcoming retirement of the shuttle system.
And that was a decision made under Bush, which, you know, part of me thinks that maybe we finally learned to operate the shuttle safely, and that it was unnecessary to shut the shuttle down.
Yeah.
Granted, it was a very expensive system and had capabilities that we didn't have any identified need for now that the space station is fully put together. But it was a unique spacecraft that can do things nothing else can do. And we are in the somewhat embarrassing position of not having our own ride to Earth orbit for a long time, probably.
Yeah, it's. I really think we blinked, if you know, almost like I remember when they canceled. I remember when Apollo was canceled, and Nixon basically canceled just about everything but the shuttle. The shuttle was supposed to be a minor component of a much grander vision, and it ended up just being the sole component. And it was cool for the first couple of missions, but then, like I said, I mean, I was at the first landing of Columbia with a million of my closest friends at Edwards Air Force Base. Uh-huh. And it was cool for those first couple of missions. And then you started thinking, and then when they brought the Hubble up there and they repaired the Hubble. All that stuff was cool. But then you started thinking, you know, going around the block since 1973, we're NASA. You know, where are we going? And
as you say, it was a building block that could have led to much more ambitious missions, you know, with the ability to reliably and relatively cheaply launch, you know, things that weigh 50,000 pounds and can fit in the payload bay of the shuttle. You can assemble in Earth orbit an interplanetary spacecraft that way. But we never, and the space station is a wonderful thing. I'm very much for the space station, but there were more things that we could have done with the shuttle. It became at one point almost a truck for launching commercial satellites.
$500 million semi truck.
Right. Yeah.
Right. Cool truck, but a truck nonetheless. So Apollo 17 splashes down, and all of a sudden, you're out of a job. Or are you? What'd you do after?
We immediately started talking about space station. There were some discussions about the crew interface of the space station that I contributed to.
This is Skylab, correct?
Well, no, Skylab, I think of Skylab as being, you know, a continuation of Apollo. And, of course, there was no LEM. And, you know, the command module wasn't doing anything too interesting other than providing transportation. But it was, you know, it was still, and that's, you know, an Apollo command module running Apollo software. But I didn't have any direct hand in planning those missions or writing any additional software on account of those Skylab missions. They were great missions, especially that first one.
Oh yeah, repairing the having to put the blanket over the ripped off shield and all that stuff was great. That was all drama.
Flying formation with the spacecraft poking at it with a stick. You know, Pete Conrad crawling out on the panel arm. It was a great mission.
Letting loose the stuck solar panel and all that stuff that was just right stuff all the way down.
So during those middle years, I can't even tell you everything I did, but a variety of things, mostly connected with manned space flight.
I remember that over at Edwards, they stuck an Apollo guidance computer in an A-8 attack aircraft and were using it to. And in the first instances of fly-by-wire, were you a part of that program at all?
I was a minor part of that program. I can't even remember exactly what I did, but I remember flying using the simulator as part of that program. I must have written some software for that.
I thought that was a great repurposing of some good software.
Well, we started running, you know, we were another major project we had was a contract to help define the requirements for the shuttle. We maintained something called an integrated package simulation, which was a fairly across the board simulation of the avionics and the shuttle and a version of shuttle software that we threw together. And it was never intended to be flight software. But I worked on that for some years. And developed sort of a paper pilot capability called Timeliner in the early 80s, working on shuttle, which basically included the ability to reach out and touch the system in various ways, not just in ways that a pilot might do, but also inserting perturbations, inserting data, and doing so not just on time tags, but based on conditions that could be expressed generally. So it amounted to a language for saying when this, do that, and all the different things that come with making a language that like that capable, such as being able to have independent strings of logic going on at the same time and so forth. So I developed that to support our testing of shuttle-type programs. And we used it in-house all through the 80s for that purpose. But in the early 90s, as the space station was being designed, we realized that there was a need on the space station for something called the user interface language, which had many of the same characteristics that Timeliner did. And so we were able to sell Timeliner to NASA as the capability to provide this UIL capability on the space station, which involved a very interesting period of traveling around and talking to the flight controllers in Houston and the payload folks in Huntsville and the headquarters folks in Washington, and eventually winning them over to our idea that we could provide a better capability than the competition at lower cost, which in fact we did. So starting in 92, I led the effort to adapt this capability for use on the station. And incidentally, the Japanese Space Agency also adopted it. And we had a relationship with them where we helped them adapt their version of it to their experiment module. So that was really the second really exciting phase of my career. And as that was winding down around 98, I, in fact, retired from the space business.
And what'd you do after?
Oh, I sort of lived from project to project. I'm a photographer, among other things.
I did notice that you've got some pretty wonderful, pretty cool pictures at DonIsles.com, and you've got a gallery. You've got an exhibit going on right now, don't you?
Yes, there's quite a bit on that website, and I hope there'll be more for before long. It's building the website is the only kind of programming I do anymore, and to some extent, it does take me back.
Well, it's looking back, since you said take me back. Why don't you share with us what you think your the highlight of your Apollo experience was, and what was the low point of your Apollo experience?
Well, that's a good question. Obviously, the highlight was landing on the moon. But, you know, you don't, in the space business, you don't celebrate until you see the parachutes. So, you know, it's hard to say. You know, I went to the debriefing meeting after Apollo 11, and that was a highlight to have talked with that crew soon after they got back. There were a lot of highlights. Towards the end of the program, I had a really good thing going on, a really good life going on in a sense, because I had I'd already seen one Saturn V. I was at the 502 launch of the 502 mission, which was the second Saturn V that went off unmanned and had a variety of problems. And despite which, the third Saturn V is the one that took Apollo 8 to the moon. For the last three missions, I developed a pattern. Well, part of the fallout from Apollo 14 was something called erasable memory programs, and they were what we chose not to do on 14. But we realized that we could develop little snippets of software that could be sort of on hand and sort of a library that could be used to deal with various malfunctions, such as a missing CDU angle from the IMU, for example. So I worked on developing some of those things. And so my pattern became to fly down to Florida the night before the launch. There was no point in going sooner than that, because in the last period before the launch, the simulators belonged just to the astronauts, and anybody who wasn't, you know, vetted as healthy wasn't welcome. But as soon as the astronauts left to fly to the moon, there were the 3 days while they were coasting out when the simulator was completely available.
So everybody got to play.
So I would get to see the launch, and then I'd spend a few days in the simulator, and then I'd fly back to Cambridge, which was my station, you know, when the landing actually happened. And so that was a nice life, you know, the beach at Cocoa Beach coupled with the launch, and then, having this wonderful toy of this LEM mission simulator at KSC to play with by myself for a few days. So the Apollo project was all highlights. If I look for a low light, I'm not sure what it would have been. You know, maybe I'm glossing over something, and there were discouraging bugs that were hard to find, and there were occasional moments of disagreement with my
company. Maybe just the simple cancellation of the program before they could finish the whole run.
Well, that's true. That was very disappointing.
Looking back, I still can't believe we just turned around and said, "All right, you know, we're done," and we never went back. Or even went further out. I just, you know, I'm one of those people that believes that man is hardwired for exploration. Is you know, and that if we don't do it, we're going to be a miserable people, and we're miserable people as it is. And you know, when Dave Scott said, you know, that man must explore, I really don't know what we're going to do if we can't.
Well, I agree with you. I think it's one of the things that's good about human nature. You know, I think to some extent, you know, one of the things I witnessed during the space program and working at the instrumentation lab, which also had a big hand in providing guidance systems for weapons of war, the space program sort of served to sort of pump some of that technology that created for the military to sort of pump it into the more open civilian sector. And
which is what makes this possible. I'm looking at my computers and talking on the internet, and all those things could not have happened unless you guys hadn't blazed the trails for others to come behind you.
Well, that's right. And this, you know, doing a space mission like going to the moon is, you know, it's so very clear that it's not a country doing it. It's a planet doing it. It's a civilization on Earth doing it. Not a specific group within that nation. So I think it does have a very important role in elevating the human spirit. But on the other hand, if the confidence isn't there, if the spirit's not there, it's pretty hard to sort of set in motion the clockwork to make it happen.
Yeah. I think we capture glimpses of it. I remember when we first sent the rover to Mars and it landed on July 4th. I caught a glimpse of that spirit then. Everybody talked about it for days. Every once in a while, you know, they announced that the Spirit and Opportunity are entering their, like, I think it's like their fifth year of operation when they were only supposed to last 30 days. Yeah. And you know, and people start talking about it. And I remember those, and I see just like the embers of the fire, the campfire, it's just glowing a little bit. But, you know, I don't know what it'll take to actually fan the flame and really get people wanting to go again. And when you consider how cheap it is per person, per capita, to do manned space flight compared to the, like you said, the offshoot benefits that we receive from it, just creating new technologies alone makes it almost worth it to go.
Well, I agree with you. Yeah.
So photography. You've got some really interesting. Real quick, are you still shooting with film, or did you go completely digital? And what do you think of digital?
Well, it's inevitable. It's unavoidable. I'm mostly shooting digital now. I'm not sure what sort of photographer I am now. You know, what you saw on the website, you know, there are the sort of symmetry tricks that you see, and that to me is interesting, and that's an example of things that you can do with digital that you would have difficulty doing by the old techniques. On the other hand, what I think of as my more serious work is the documentation of this big construction project we had in Boston called the Big Dig, and there's quite a bit of that on the website.
Oh, you photographed the Big Dig. That's pretty interesting.
Yes. The on the front page, the 101 views of the Zakin Bridge, that'll take you to a lot of it. And that was all shot with film. And if I were doing that kind of work again, I would shoot film again. You know, you can gather more information under that negative using film than you can do with, I think, practically any digital camera, except maybe some extremely expensive ones that are way out of my price range. The big stuff is all shot in 6x9 centimeter format.
What do you shoot with?
Those photographs with Fuji makes a line of 6x9, made a line of 6x9 cameras.
So you shoot mostly medium format then?
Yes.
Yeah. I have a Canon 7D that I just love, and it's have you dabbled in high dynamic range photography at all?
No. No, I'm not even sure exactly what you mean by it.
It's kind of the latest, for lack of a better word, fad in digital photography, where you take advantage of the fact that many of the higher end cameras use raw uncompressed formats, mm-hmm. and you can actually boost the color saturation and play with the contrast and do a whole bunch of things. So you can take a normal digital photograph and kind of make it ethereal, where you have this look almost like it's come from another planet. It's a really interesting style of photography that I've kind of fallen in love with. Uh-huh. And I was in the sequoias last summer, and I was able to take some really wonderful pictures of all these wonderful sequoia trees. But when I got them back, the pictures were kind of, the colors were muted, they were washed out, and I was really kind of disappointed. And I applied some tone mapping to it and did some high dynamic range techniques to it, and almost got the pictures to look like the trees actually were supposed to look. And the way I remembered them. And that's what I love about digital photography, is being able to process photographs to make them look a little bit more realistic, or even to look more ethereal, to make them look outside of the what you expect.
You were shooting raw with your 7D?
I'm sorry?
You were shooting raw with your Canon 7D?
Yes. Yes, yeah. With the 7D. And it's not a full format. It's not a full frame camera, unfortunately. I couldn't afford a 5D Mark II. Those are just, you know, $3,000 a body. It's just crazy. But I really do enjoy it, and I can understand the allure of doing something completely artistic as opposed to the technical stuff that you did for so long. It's kind of like Al Bean going from being a fighter pilot to being an artist. It's a completely different world to immerse yourself in, to scratch a different kind of itch.
Well, I'm not sure I agree with you that it's a completely different world. You know, there were aspects of the space program that were like a big cooperative art project, a collaborative art project. You know, they were, it's not pure math. You're designing and you're building, and, sort of an aesthetic sense helps you there too. So I'm not one who makes such a hard distinction between art and technology.
Okay, I'll go with that. Well, an hour has gone by completely fast. We've talked for over an hour, and I want you to know I've really enjoyed it. My guest has been Don Iles, programmers of the Apollo guidance computer software that helped land man on the moon and was able to keep us on track during Apollo 14. Mr. Iles, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
You've been listening to Conversations with Apollo. For more information, visit our website at www.apollotalks.com. Got a question or comment? There's several ways to get a hold of us. Drop us a line at apollotalks@gmail.com. You can leave us feedback on the iTunes website. You can now tweet us on Twitter @@ApolloTalks. And we're also on Facebook with Apollo Talks. Theme music is from Gemini 5, courtesy of the MySpace Music Network. The song is Babylon Rockets. Visit them on the web at www.gemini5.com. Conversations with Apollo is a copyrighted podcast under the Creative Commons license from Quindar Entertainment. Copyright 2009.